week, 1 week away, Jeremy says, ooh, problem. Problem. So, you get my one week prepared lesson. So, if it comes across like a bulletin, you'll understand why I probably write better, which I may not do well either, but I probably write better than I do speak. So what I want to talk about, what I'd like to talk about tonight, are relics. Actually, more than that, relics and heirlooms. I'll talk about relics and heirlooms. I think there are several relics and heirlooms in the Bible, and I'd like to discuss those. But first, I want to talk about something a little bit closer to me than that. And that is, I thought very carefully what kind of heirlooms I had around the house. And some of you know me, and you probably know what's in this box. I'm going to pull that anyway. A long time ago, not in a galaxy far, far away, but a long time ago, there was some guy named Absalom Chrysler. And he lived in the 1820s. And he had a son named Leroy. And he was born around 1850. I actually know the exact date, but that doesn't matter. He had a son named Henry, who was born in 1880. Then there was some guy named Manuel. If he was alive today, he would hit me upside the head for calling him Manuel, because everybody called him Merle. But he had a son named Manuel, and then he had a son named William in 1933. And then there's me in 1964. All these people have something in common. They all come from large families. Well, mine's probably the smallest, because I was one of four kids. But, I'll put that there very precariously. But all the rest of them had larger than four kids. They had lots of kids. And what they all have in common, except for me, is that they are all firstborn sons. And so, somehow, this thing got into the family and was given to the first, very sacredly, given to the firstborn son, who, when he got to be old enough, gave it to his firstborn son, and so on down the line, until my father. And my father gave it to me, because my brother left the Lord. And he said, well, I want it to stay in the godly side of the family, so you get it. So I'm breaking the tradition, I'm the second born son. However, when I asked my dad, so what's the story with this China? I mean, my wife will like it, but unless I drink out of it, it doesn't mean much use to me. And he said, well, here's the deal. Your grandfather, Emmanuel, Merle, asked his dad the story, and he said, oh, it's a very interesting story. I'll tell you. And then he died. So we didn't know the story. In fact, we didn't know anything about this at all. So I can invent any story I want, which is very interesting. I can invent any story I want and say, oh, this is probably the story, you know, how could you prove me wrong? Well, I actually looked into this. This was purchased, it had to be purchased around 1850 because that's when it was made. And probably purchased by Absalom and given to James, or to Leroy. I have no idea why, who, what the story is, how it came from. Why is there only one? Why isn't there a whole set? I don't know. But it has a meaning to me because it's an heirloom from my forefathers, right? In fact, my firstborn forefathers down the line to me. So that's very interesting. So if I gave this to you, or if you went to, oh, this is worth about $10, by the way. I priced it. It's worth about $10. Well, each piece. So $20. If you went to an antique dealer and said, hey, I really like these, you want to buy them, they said, $20, they're yours. What would that mean to you? Probably nothing, right? Because there's no history behind it. Well, I have almost no history behind it. I know that enough of the story to know it came from the firstborn, and I'm ornery enough to be appreciative of the fact that I'm not a firstborn, but other than that, I really know nothing about it. So it's not, I'm waving it around like I'm going to break it, I'm going to put it down. But to you, if you bought it for $20, it would mean nothing to you. You would have no appreciation for it, okay? And I want to keep that in mind because I have other things up here that I do have appreciation for. For instance, I have appreciation for this. This is the heavy item that Bill was mentioning. And yes, I wouldn't stoop to cheap theatrics to get my eye into the picture. This is a dinosaur bone. I got it at the flea market for $3. It has lots of cartilage and stuff on it, including the hip bone, if you're curious. It's a real thing. I mean, I chop up my foot and elbow. It is quite heavy. And it's worth about $3, I think. I like it because it's a dinosaur bone, dinosaurs are cool. But someone else might look at this and say, it's a rock. It's useless, right? It has no meaning. No special attributes, no family history, it's just a rock. All right, I agree. And so I have one more cheap theatrical stunt to pull out, and that is, you probably know what this is. Now this means something to me. That's a Furby, Brian. Yeah, I see you squinting at looking at what that is. It's a little demon toy that comes alive at the most inappropriate times for us to speak for no apparent reason. When we first moved here, like 9 years ago, Dave got one of these. He said no, but all the kids had them, Mary had them, and you know, everybody, Nate had to have one. So some of the kids had several. And it was a very amusing toy because it was funny, but Dave was so attached to it. Now, this isn't his actual Furby. I could trick you and tell you that it is. And Dave's saying, don't tell what the actual Furby is. I won't, but I will tell you this is not the actual Furby, but it's dead on the right model, make, coloring. This is what his Furby used to look like before something happened to it that I'm not supposed to tell you. But it's an heirloom to me. I suspect that if something happened to me, that my son would not just go through my belongings and say, huh, old Furby, 50 cents. I suspect he would keep it. If nothing else, he might keep it for his own children, or maybe for uncle or for uncle, or nephew or someone. Because it has a certain history to it, right? And he would say, oh, I had one of these when I was a kid. Now, all of you probably have something, maybe something very old in your house, that you had when you were a kid, or it just means something to you because it was given to you from your father, your grandfather, some special reason. And you may never thought about it before, but you'd like to pass that on to someone else. Well, there are some things in the Bible that get passed on to other people, and sometimes it's a problem for the people it gets passed to, and sometimes it's not a problem for them, but for someone incidentally, and sometimes, well, we'll talk about that when we get there. But let's look at a few of these things. Oh, a coincidence, by the way, was that to help figure out when this actually was made. We were on our trip to Yellowstone, and we stopped with a steamboat that had sunk in the Missouri River. It just sank like a rock, and it took all the trade goods down with it. And we were looking at the trade goods, but they dug the steamboat up, and looking at the trade goods, and Denise says, look at all those cups. They have no handles. They look just like that weird cup that your dad gave you. Well, sure enough, the steamboat sank in 1853, so it's the right period, so it helped us identify. But, some heirlooms that are in the Bible. And maybe you'll think of them as heirlooms or relics, but they are. The first one I want to talk about is the brass serpent. And you say, what's the story with the brass serpent? Okay. Well, the story of the brass serpent is found in Numbers 21. It's a very short reading. I'm going to read it to you. It's found in Numbers 21, and it starts in verse 5. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. This is when they're in the wilderness. Wherefore have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much the people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord, and against you. Pray unto the Lord that he will take the serpents away from us. And Moses prayed for the people, and the Lord said to Moses, make thee a fiery serpent, and set it on a pole, and it shall come to pass, that everyone that is bitten, when he looks upon it, shall live. And Moses made a serpent of brass, and he put it on a pole, and it came to pass that the serpent had bitten any man. When he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. This is a cool relic. Very useful relic. And they had it for a long time among the people. And they could look at this and say, hey, this is that relic. This is that very brass serpent that God saved us with when these serpents came among us. You know, this brass serpent. But what happened? Well, about 700 years later, all right, in 2 Kings chapter 18, we hear about this fiery brass serpent again. And in 2 Kings chapter 18, starting in verse 1, it says, now it came to pass in the third year of Hosea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, the king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he, and he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was also Abby, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places, and he broke the images, and cut down the groves, and brake in pieces the brazen serpents that Moses had made. Why? For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it. And he called it some funny name, Nehushtan. So, what happens to a relic when you abuse it, when you look at it and assign too much, well, something different than it was intended. In fact, they used it as an idol. Obviously, God gave them this brass serpent for salvation, yet they worked it into something that was evil among the people. So be careful about these ancient things, because sometimes ancient things need to simply be left in the past. They have a use, use them, leave them alone. All right. Another cool relic that I'd love to see, and it's been in movies, so other people must want to find it too, is the Ark of the Covenant. That's a very interesting relic. It's first mentioned, as far as I can tell, in Exodus chapter 25, around verse 8. And the Ark of the Covenant has an interesting history. The first thing it says in Exodus 25 is God speaking, says, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." So God's going to be in this sanctuary. "According to all that I show you after the pattern of the tabernacle, and let the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall you make of it, and they shall make an ark of wood, and no 10 cubits and a half, oops, not 10 cubits, 2 cubits, pretty big. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and a cubit and a half the breadth, and a cubit and a half shall be the height, so not that big, and thou shalt overlay it with pure gold within and without, shall thou overlay it, and shall lay it, or shall bank upon it a crown of gold about, and thou shalt cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them in the 4 corners thereof, and 2 rings shall be in the side of it, and 2 rings on the other side of it." All right, so there it is, being made. Why was it being made? Because God said so. Because God was going to dwell as a sanctuary among them in this ark. And they're supposed to treat it a certain way, they're supposed to put it in a certain place. As we know, they're supposed to carry it a certain way, and that's how it was supposed to be. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 4, about 350 years later, it's mentioned again, and the people have a really wacky idea what to do with this Ark of the Covenant. They came to the camp, in verse 3, where they're fighting the Philistines, and the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord smitten us this day before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant, the Lord, out of Shiloh unto us, that when it comes among us, it will save us from the hand of our enemies." I don't remember it being built for that particular reason, but that's the reason that they're going to use it for, they think. So the people went to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, which dwelt between the cherubims, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does this mean, this noise, the great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid. They knew this artifact, for they said, "God is come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for there has not been such a thing before." The ark's never been used this way before. This is something different. Even the enemies knew this. All right? "Woe to us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Quit yourselves and fight like men." Well, you know what happened. The Philistines won. Why did the Philistines win? This was not the intention of the Ark of the Covenant. It was not for the pride of battle to be used to fight with. Yet that's what happened. It was misused, and there's a story behind that. But eventually, the children of Israel get the Ark of the Covenant back. And 1 Chronicles 13, this is 450 years after the Ark was made. In 1 Chronicles 13, verse 1, it says, "And David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds, with every leader. And David said to all the congregation of Israel, 'If it seems good to you, and it be to the Lord our God, and good to the Lord our God, let us send abroad of our brethren everywhere that are left in the hand of Israel, and with them also the priests and Levites which are in the cities and suburbs, that they may gather themselves unto us, and let us bring again the Ark of the Covenant, or the Ark of God, to us. For we inquired not at it in the days of Saul.' And all the congregation said they would do so, for the thing was right in the sight, or right in the eyes of the people." All right? So David has a great idea. The Ark of the Covenant has been lost. When it was returned, people opened the Ark and they got killed by the hundreds. So they left it where it was. And David says, "You know, we need to worship God the way we should be doing it. Let's go get the Ark and bring it back. Let's go find all these Levites that are scattered everywhere, bring them back, and let's do things right." And everybody said, "This sounds like a great idea." Unfortunately, the way they moved the Ark was not a good idea. And as we know, a man was killed because they did not handle the ark properly. So this is a relic, an artifact. All right? At this time, about 450 years old, but still very potent. Why? It's the sanctuary of God, and they should have had more respect for it. Okay? So, we should have respect for some of these artifacts. They could be very dangerous, or they could be misused. Okay, so Jeremiah 3 is the last mention I could find of the ark, and he mentions the ark, and he says, "Turn, O backsliding children, says the Lord, for I am married unto you, and I will take you out and take you one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion, and I will give you pastors according to my heart, which shall feed you with knowledge and understanding." This is God speaking. "And it shall come to pass, when you be multiplied and increased in the land, in those days, says the Lord, they shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done anymore." In other words, God has looked at this and said, this relic is no longer needed by you. And so, what I want to point out about these things is sometimes a decision is made that something can be very dangerous, and it's no longer necessary, and God himself takes it away. And so you say, well, what happens to the Ark of the Covenant? People are searching all over the globe for it, right? I don't think they're going to find it, because God says it goes away here. Okay, we have a couple other simple relics that I want to talk about. One of those is the temple cups. All the vessels of gold and silver that were made for the temple, in about 1000 B.C., and finally, 1 Kings chapter 7, it talks about Solomon, who does build the temple. "And Solomon made all the vessels that pertain unto the house of the Lord, and the altar of God, and the table of gold, whereupon the showbread was, and the candlesticks of pure gold, five on the right side and five on the left, before the oracle, with the flowers and the lamps and the tongs of gold, and the bowls and the snuffers and the basins and the spoons and the censers of pure gold and the hinges of gold, both for the doors of the inner house and the most holy place and for the doors of the house, to wit, of the temple." Okay, not just any house. Come on, the house of God. Now, if you remember, one of the kings shows this treasure to these foreigners and says, "Look at all this wealth we have." Those foreigners say, that's very interesting. And they happen to be working for some guy named Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, gold over there, very interesting. And so because of that, they end up losing all this, but it's taken to Babylon. I actually read the passage about that, but Nebuchadnezzar comes, and he robs the house of the Lord, and he takes all this gold, and he takes it back to Babylon. But his grandson, in Daniel chapter 5, all right, now this is 500 years later, after these cups have been made, all right, these cups are 500 years old. His grandson, named Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for a thousand of his lords, and drank wine before the thousand. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes and wives and his concubines drank in them. And they drank wine and praised the gods of gold, of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand, and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, his thoughts troubled him, so the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. His knees were shaking so bad, his legs were knocking together. Alright, what happened here? Well, if we know the story, there's no mercy for him. Now, Nebuchadnezzar took the stuff. He stole the stuff out of the temple. But he did it in ignorance, and he learned his lesson. And he learned that there was one true God. But Belshazzar, his grandson, should have seen Nebuchadnezzar's life, he grew up in his lifetime, should have learned the lesson, should have known about it. In fact, he knows that Daniel is the guy who helped out his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. He knows a lot, but he doesn't seem to grasp the point that you don't mock God, especially not with items from the temple that are sanctified and put in the temple for his use. And that's what he does. He mocks God ignorantly, but not ignorantly enough. And Daniel tells him, you should have known better. And he ends up going down. So, my point about the heirloom there is don't mock God with these things, especially things that are sanctified by him, and especially when you know better. Now, there are some other things that we think about. Other antiques or relics or heirlooms that I would love to find But I think God lost them on purpose. For instance, the biggest one I can think of is the other ark. Right? Where is Noah's ark? People say, if I could see Noah's ark, I would believe in God. Well, people say that about all kinds of things. People in the New Testament, as Kurt and I pointed out on the radio show, saw Jesus do things like make the blind man see. And yet, they didn't see anything. Right? They just refused to accept it. And they saw a miracle. But people today say, well, show me the ark. Show me the ark of Noah. Right? It's not there. Why is it not there? Well, I have a theory about that. There are a couple other antiques, I think, or relics I think God lost on purpose. There's this chalice people always talk about, some kind of a cup. Right? And I think all the personal items of Jesus and the apostles are gone. I think they're long gone, although the Catholic Church may tell you different. I also think that there's a rugged cross that no longer exists. Now, I don't know that for sure, but I highly suspect it. And I'll tell you why I highly suspect it. Because I think there's a lesson there for us looking at these items. God doesn't base anyone's faith on physical items. All right? When he raised the brass serpent, he raised it so that they would act through faith. Think about that. He's, you know, the snakes come in, people are dying, and he says, you go look at the brass serpent, you'll live. The brass serpent isn't medicine. The brass serpent is a focus for your faith. Right? That's what saved the people. It was because they acted on their faith. Right? God doesn't say, from now on, we're going to have this brass serpent, and you have to bow down to it and pray to it. In fact, what he does do is have a man that's like-minded like him come along and destroy it, because that's what the people are doing. Right? These relics pass away, and God has a hand in them. Like Jeremiah said about the Ark of the Covenant. God had a hand in the Ark of the Covenant. That's the most powerful symbol of God, and it was no longer time for that to be. And so it was taken away. All right? So my theory about these other antiques, these other relics, is that people get caught up worshiping the relics and not worshiping God. Right? One of the apostles does not believe, right? You know Thomas, does not believe until I see the holes in his hands and the side that was pierced, I won't accept, right? And then he shows him, and what did Jesus say? Here I am. Right? And I'm going to appear to everybody that ever lived so they can see me too. Right? Because everybody needs physical proof. That's not what he says. He says, blessed are those who what? Who believe because they see him, but more blessed are who? Those who believe without seeing. Right? Right? So I think God eliminates a lot of these relics and these antiques, right, and these heirlooms, because they're a stumbling block. And God removes these stumbling blocks. They serve a purpose. And they have a good purpose. Even things like the brass serpent that was ordained by God has a good, sound purpose. But it becomes valueless when it causes those to stumble, right? The very people that it was intended to help. So, how does that translate to us today? Well, it's the same God. And God wants us to believe. He wants us to believe based on his word. And we have a lot of preachers come through and say, we don't have the actual writings of John or the actual writings of some other apostles. We have copies of them, and we're very confident in the copies, but we don't have the actual writing. I kind of thought, even at that time, I'm glad we don't have the actual writing, because handwriting experts would probably have a field day saying, you know, Paul was a woman hater, I can prove it because he makes extra loops in his R's or something. I mean, the thing is, people get caught up on the physical, right? And they want something to affirm their faith. And all they need, all we need to affirm our faith is the Word, knowledge of the Word. Read the eyewitness accounts, right? Come to a better understanding of the mind of God. It's revealed to us. And that's the heirloom that we still have today. Jesus, God, had a plan. Before the founding of the world, we know that they had a plan for man's salvation. And we know that that plan was carried out, and God's will could not be thwarted. And that men were used, both good and evil, throughout all the history of the Bible, to carry across God's purpose. That is what we inherit. What we inherit is the result, the Word, something that people in the Old Testament would love to have had, the conclusion, the mystery revealed. We have it. Let's not squander it. All right? There's a relic. And when you think of relic, you often think, oh, it's dusty, and it's just something interesting. Put it in a museum, and we'll study it. This is a relic that brings us to life, right, and can give us life today. right? That's the only relic that God wants to abide, because he says his word will abide forever, right? And why? Because its purpose will never end. As long as we are here on this earth, as long as there are souls that are alive, the purpose of the word will not end. These other things were taken away, some by godly men, some by God himself, but they were taken away because they were not necessary, they were stumbling blocks, and they were removed, right? And these little artifacts I have in my own life are very interesting artifacts. Yet, I wouldn't share my salvation for a piece of stone. Or a piece of stone. Right? These don't mean anything in the end. But the word abides forever. So, consider that carefully. And if your life is one where your faith is wavering and you need to reaffirm your faith, or if you're ready to put on Christ and accept him as your Savior, and know that that's the only permanent thing that there is salvation with the Lord, right? Well, there is something else that's permanent, eternal damnation. If you want to avoid that and have eternal joy with God in heaven, then make your life right. Come forward and request to be baptized, or come forward and ask for the prayers to help you to make your life right before God. If you need this in any way, please signify that by coming forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.